you're trying to make artificial intelligence, what is intelligence? You know, one of the common metaphors is, do submarines swim? No, but they're very good at going through the water, which is what you want a submarine to do. And that's the era that we're at with AI and machine learning. Like, what they're doing is very good at going through the water, but it's not swimming as a fish is. It's not experiencing what a fish is experiencing.
Everybody's talking about AI these days. Can there be beauty in AI? And if so, what about the dangers that it poses to our humanity and to our flourishing? To answer these questions today, I'm talking to Brian Mullins, the CEO of Mind Foundry. I am Brandon Vaidyanathan, and this is Beauty at Work, a podcast that seeks to expand our understanding of beauty, what it is, how it works, and why it matters, especially for the work we do. Brian Mullins has been at the forefront of how technology can positively change people's lives throughout his career. He's more than a decade of experience in high-growth technology companies across industries such as artificial intelligence, augmented reality, and robotics. He's been awarded more than 100 patents, has been asked to testify as an expert before the U.S. Senate, received an Edison Award for industrial design, and was named one of the CNBC Disruptor 50 and was selected as one of Goldman Sachs' 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. His company, Mind Foundry, is an Oxford University company operating at the intersection of innovation, research, and usability. The Mind Foundry platform empowers organizations with responsible AI built for high-stakes applications where decisions affect the lives of individuals or are made at the scale of populations. In my conversation with Brian, he assures us that while there are certainly serious risks associated with AI, we're nowhere near the ability of machine learning models to gain consciousness. So whether you find the singularity beautiful or frightening, it's not happening anytime soon. We talk about some remarkable applications of AI to solve problems that afflict humanity and ways in which AI-human collaborations can help expand our creative potential as human beings. So without further ado, let's get started. This episode is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust. More about them later in the show. Hey, Brian, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's so great to have you.
Brandon, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, wonderful. So one of the things I typically like to ask people these days about beauty is, could you think of an experience from your childhood that still lingers with you, an experience of profound beauty? And it doesn't have to be the very first experience you had or anything, but anything that that word evokes for you, a memory, a sensation, what stays with you?
What a great question, because there's so many types of beauty and so many impressions of beauty I have from childhood. It's interesting. I perhaps think a little bit differently about it. And the example that comes to mind isn't going to be the typical moving aesthetic beauty, but rather I remember having this observation and asking my dad when we got a new couch, how come couches fit through doors?
Wow.
And I asked, did somebody plan it? Is there a rule that they have to? And he explained to me how that, no, people who make couches, they understand that there are doors involved and that it would be good for them to make their couches in a way that they fit through doors. And that there was this implicit understanding in the human condition of the customers of the couches. And as strange as that was, that kind of, you know, geometric relationship of that understanding of the human experience is one of the most profoundly beautiful things that I remember when I was very young. And also I got to mention an interaction with my dad, which who I love deeply.
Yeah. Wow. There's a profundity to that, right? Because it's in part a combination of human ingenuity in terms of what we're building, but also just the affordances of our environments and the importance of designing in a way that doesn't simply solve the problem of where do I sit, but then how is it going to be positioned in the environments in which I'm actually going to live? And I think a lot of design tends to neglect that seemingly commonsensical set of considerations, no?
Yeah, no, it's very true. And yet when it gets it right, or, you know, when things conspire to put those together, the geometry, the kind of shape of the world, it takes on a beautiful form.
Yeah, fantastic. Ryan, you were named one of the CNBC Disruptor 50 and one of Goldman Sachs' 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. And I'm curious to know whether you would use words like intriguing and disruptive to describe yourself. And if so, in what sense?
I'm not sure that I would. It wouldn't necessarily be my go-to, though. I do like disruption, generally speaking. And I'm a very curious person. So I guess if I was intriguing, I think that's a wonderful thing. And I like disruption because it speaks to, you know, breaking established patterns. I think it can be a very positive thing. I think the word doesn't hold a positive or negative connotation inherently for me, but that the idea that you could disrupt patterns that were limiting yourself or patterns that were limiting groups of people, I think that's an awesome thing. And so, I was honored to get those acknowledgments, and I think they're pretty rad.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little bit more later about what those disruptions look like. Tell us a bit about your childhood and where you grew up and how you got into both the tech space as well as entrepreneurship. What drew you in that direction?
Yeah, so I grew up in the United States in Southern California, and I went to college at the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point in New York. I studied engineering and was an engineering officer in the United States Naval Reserve, and later got my start in venture-backed technology.
Oh, sorry, what led you to the Navy?
The Academy. So,
okay.
So it's interesting. It's amazing school. It's one of the five Federal Service Academies in the U.S.
Yeah.
And by default, all of the graduates have a commission in the U.S. Navy. And though it has a unique position amongst service academies, where I had classmates that went to all of the federal services, which is pretty awesome.
Okay. And so from there, you were in engineering, and then how did you decide to move into entrepreneurship?
Yeah. So, you know, I actually was working for the government initially and ended up at the Space and Naval Warfare Lab in San Diego, California. And then I was employed by Booz Allen Hamilton, the consultancy, but working in a, you know, U.S. government lab. And it was a really, really interesting time for me because a lot of really smart people trying to solve really hard problems. And I use the term cross-pollinate ideas. You get to see people that are solving problems with hardware or software or sensors or logistics or, you know, statistics and everything in between, because of just the immensity of the operations that are necessary to support, you know, something like the U.S. Navy. And you get to work with, you know, people that are, you know, some of the brightest minds in those fields. I learned quite a bit and really wanted to take that and ended up starting a business with some friends. It was an engineering services business where we worked with automation and robotics. And I actually had a period of time in my career where I got to go to different factories where different things were made and troubleshoot automation and robotics that was not working. So things I'd never seen before and processes I'd never seen before, but I knew the automation and systems and I knew the robotic systems. And that was amazing to me because I got to see, like, how is food made industrially? How are cosmetics made? How are automobiles made? How are pharmaceuticals made? And just about everything in between. It's just fascinating to see human ingenuity and where ideas are shared and cross-pollinated. You have some of these amazing effects, and then sometimes you have these baffling things where a food factory and a pharmaceutical factory use the same sterile stainless steel component, but they don't know it. And one of them pays hundreds of dollars, and one of them pays hundreds of thousands of dollars for it.
Oh, wow.
Because they don't cross-pollinate. And it's fascinating to kind of see the disconnects and how those inefficiencies occur as well.
Hmm. So how did you leverage that? I mean, what was your first entrepreneurial initiative and how did that go?
Yeah, so then, you know, I think I went from there. I had encountered a technology called augmented reality in my days at the Space Naval Warfare Lab. And this was where you could take, at the time it wasn't wearable or anything, you could take a video feed of the world. So it was like, you know, looking through a camera, and you could essentially put in special effects in real time. And I remember the example that I saw was there was this diorama of a city. So it was like a model of a city on a tabletop, and someone held a camera and kind of flew it around at street level. And then they put it in digitally into the video in real time a bunch of these zombies walking around. It was like a little bit of a gimmick, but I immediately saw the power of it. I said, this is like, it was like special effects in real time. And if you could get it closer to the eyes, so you could get it so that people could see it when you're looking around, can you imagine, you know, how much faster you could bring information and more importantly, knowledge to people, wherever they're at, whatever they were doing, you know? But this was, you know, way ahead of its time, probably in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so it took a while for the technology to evolve. And I remember one year, it was on my birthday, I went to a set of talks in Los Angeles with my wife just for, you know, a special evening out. And one of the talks was somebody talking about doing augmented reality on a mobile phone.
Huh.
And it was the first time I'd seen somebody moved it into that form factor. And I thought, oh my gosh, so now's the time.
Yeah.
If you could do it on a phone, you know, you could do it. You could do it somewhere else. That was probably in 2010 or 11. It was very early. And so it was still way ahead of its time. But that's actually how I got into venture-backed technologies. That passion for how technology could empower people really drove me to start my first venture and learn the world of venture-backed technology. And you know, that ultimately led me to where I'm at today, which is in Oxford as the CEO of Mind Foundry, which is an artificial intelligence company.
Yeah, tell us about Mind Foundry and how did that get started and what do you all do?
Mind Foundry was started by Professor Steve Roberts and Professor Mike Osborne from the Machine Learning Research Group at the University of Oxford. And it was spun out in order to create AI for high-stakes applications where decisions would affect people's lives or would be made at the scale of populations in a way that made them a safety-critical application. You couldn't do just off-the-shelf AI where all too often were seduced by the speed and performance of AI without knowing what's the fundamental method of action, like what's going on under the hood.
Yeah.
You actually had to do AI differently. You had to approach it like a safety critical system, and you had to develop specific methods that would give you insight into how it operated, how a decision was made, and what the potential for failures would be. So that whether the environment was regulated or had specific governance requirements, that you could understand what the impact would be on people's lives. And when I heard that two professors who were famous for their work academically in machine learning who were looking for a CEO to scale that business, it took me about 30 seconds to want to be a part of it. When I met them, they're super humble. Even if you're not super close to AI as an industry, most people have read The Economist's Future of Work series about how AI will take work or transform the workplace, which is based on Professor Osborne's work that he did. You know, Professor Roberts has been a professor for about 30 years and has, I think, over 100,000 citations. Just amazing, amazing man. And it's a pleasure to work with both of them and the team that they've created.
Yeah. Are there particular kinds of, well, maybe, you know, for those in our audience who are not too familiar with AI, I mean, you know, everyone's heard of ChatGPT probably by now, but tell us a bit about specifically how the systems you're working with operate and what exactly are you doing and what particular problems are you solving?
I think that's an important set of questions people should ask about AI more broadly. I think we're very comfortable with people calling the industry AI, right, is a super category. Everything in it is artificial intelligence, but it's really made up of a lot of things. You know, and technically, most of those things are probably best characterized as machine learning, even in the examples that you mentioned. And what AI is probably a topic of great debate. But within the methods that, you know, are available in AI, some are much more understandable than others. And some allow you to do things more quickly, but at the cost of understanding. And so there's always a balance in, okay, how do we innovate? And then how do we make it robust for use in the real world? Mm-hmm. And there's a tension between those things, but I don't think that there's a conflict between them.
Yeah.
And we don't think there is either. And so we work across a spectrum of technologies where innovation needs to occur. But we have a greater level of requirement in understanding throughout the pipeline of an AI or machine learning application. So what what does the data represent and how is it collected? You know, what are the model types that are most appropriate when that's the case? What are they capable of? And then more importantly, as you get to the other side of the pipeline, what decisions are going to be made based upon the recommendations of the system? What interventions might be taken and what are the direction of those interventions? And how can we combine those things together in a way that limits risks, allows the automated systems to do what they do best, but allows the people and actually, you know, relies on collaborating with people in a way that make both together able to accomplish more than they would be able to alone, which is pretty powerful. And we've seen that with all kinds of AI applications. You know, I think one of the early examples that still is you know, evolving to this day is how chess is played in a world with AI. And now, if we're all honest, I think very simple chess programs beat most of us.
Right.
And so, so the day that AI beat a grandmaster, you know, I mean, it seems like a lot, but it was already, you know, basic computer programs were better than most of us. But I, you know, a lot of people predicted from that the death of playing chess or certainly the sport of professional chess. And it just wasn't the case. Not only does it still go on, there's also hybrid chess where you can team up with an AI or you can play alone or you can have an AI play alone and people do in all those configurations. And I think we're currently in a period where AI only teams are winning most of the time. But for most of the time since AI came around, actually human and AI teams together were much more powerful. And so there's these, you know, kind of unexpected dimensions where, the AI is powerful, can beat a grandmaster, but then it turns out you could take a high school level player and put them together with an AI and they could outperform any grandmaster in the world.
Yeah.
And it's because you could leverage the strengths of both.
Yeah.
And then there's a great anecdote, I think, from the last 5 or 10 years where a couple of guys were playing who were not chess players at all, and they weren't AI players either. They just had this crazy theory that if they made some moves every once in a while that were unexpected, then the AI could do what it did, that the opposition could never really kind of get a lock on what they were doing. And they were right. They won the championship, you know, multiple years for the hybrid competition. And, you know, so it just really, really shows that as the technology is evolving, we don't really understand the implication. We don't know what's going to replace humans entirely and what is going to benefit from the collaboration together. I will go on record with saying the idea that we're close to a super intelligence emerging from the technology and it kind of superstitiously becoming self-aware feels very superstitious from where we sit. There's nothing in the method of operation of these systems that is persistent beyond a single request where consciousness could emerge even if we thought that the mechanisms and the models at all, you know, were capable of doing so. It's the complexity that's represented in these systems, while impressive from an application standpoint, doesn't even approach the complexity that's found in you know, what is necessary for human consciousness. And I think we really need to temper expectations. It's exciting to see, and sometimes scary, an AI do things that only humans had previously done.
Yeah.
But it's also a little bit of a gimmick.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I think one, you know, kind of clear illustration of that is the architectures that are, you know, breaking new ground today, these kind of transformer-based architectures that are doing cool things with text that kind of scares us and makes us think, you know, is it self-aware, are not totally dissimilar to the same type of generative architectures for images, right? But when we see an image generator make a picture, especially if it's got, you know, 20 fingers, none of us are afraid that model's even remotely close to being self-aware and is going to take over the planet. For some reason, when we put text in it, it scares us. And I think it's because it's, you know, that's something that's been uniquely human. We haven't gone through the uncanny valley of looking at graphics and computer-based images and kind of gotten used to the synthetic nature of images and video. That's not to say that it's not powerful. It's not to say that there's not risks in how you apply it and where you use it and the risk that will occur economically and how things are transformed. But it is my personal hard stance is that we're nowhere near super intelligence. And, you know, if that's something that you're afraid of, don't worry about it. If it's something that you're really looking forward to, I'm sorry.
Well, what I want to ask you, let's talk a bit about that, because there are people who I think find it, part of what the beauty is they find in AI is the kind of seductions of this idea of singularity or of being able to somehow transcend our humanity, right? And then you have post-humanism and transhumanism and various other kinds of ideologies that I think are seeing in AI the potential to transcend all of our human limitations. And in technology more generally, like whether it's the ability to live forever or the kind of ability to have to some kind of super intelligence that can mitigate all of the challenges that we face, whether or not that intelligence would turn against us is a different story. But what assumptions about intelligence are being made there, do you see? And why do you think we can't get there, or at least that it's not within any kind of immediate scope? In terms of arriving at that kind of a future?
Yeah, so I think that's the question of our day. You would have to first define what's intelligence.
Yeah.
Right? If you're trying to make artificial intelligence, what is intelligence? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the common metaphors is, you know, do submarines swim? Mm. No. But they're very good at going through the water, which is what you want a submarine to do. And that's the era that we're at with AI and machine learning. Like what they're doing is very good at, you know, going through the water, but it's not swimming as a fish is. It's not experiencing what a fish is experiencing. And I think if you look at the, you know, just the complexity of the human brain and the entire organic system around it, and just from an information standpoint, the complexity of every cell in our body that's contributing to the conversations and the motivations and what's going on to underpin, you know, that conscious experience, it is significantly greater than anything we've been able to abstract into a computer. Right? And if you just do basic, you know, back of the napkin math, the entire corpus of all, you know, written documents that would be used to train a large language model is less information than the average 4-year-old child would see with their eyes throughout their life, right? Hmm. And so just from a magnitude of training data, in order to get, you know, if you believed that the human experience was purely a brute force neural network, that all I needed was enough data to make sense of the world, we're nowhere near the complexity that the average human does at the age of 4, yeah. Right? And yes, if it's in written text form, there's more text than any one human could experience in their life. But
sure,
there's a lot more to understanding, you know, the world and the human condition than just the text documents. You probably, you know, even in that brute force configuration, you need to live as a human in human environments. Even to make that form of brute force learned human consciousness viable from an information and compute standpoint, I don't think it adds up. That doesn't mean that we're not going to be able to make really powerful machines that do awesome stuff. And there are risks associated with them as much as there are opportunities. Like that's not what that means. It's just when you go one step further and you say, oh man, you know, like the next version on the current trajectory of development on this curve could be, you know, the singularity. It doesn't seem like that's actually realistic. Are we on an amazing hockey stick up curve in technology and innovation? Yes. But, you know, that curve is defined by an equation that if I zoom in or zoom out, the curve looks the same no matter where you're at on it. and so, you know, whether you realize, you know, in the macro or the micro, yes, things are changing quickly. That doesn't mean that there's still not a lot of development that is still far away from the point that we're at, and that is where we are.
You're listening to Beauty at Work. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust as part of a grant on the aesthetic dimensions of science. Templeton Religion Trust supports projects as well as storytelling related to projects that seek to enrich the conversation about religion. To learn more about them, visit templetonreligiontrust.org. If you're enjoying the show so far, please subscribe to our podcast and take a moment to leave us a review.
Talk a little bit about the work you all have done at Mind Foundry, and what do you find beautiful about it? Where do you encounter beauty in the work that you're doing?
Well, I'd just like to talk about AI, we'd have to define what intelligence is. You know, what is beauty? Mm-hmm. I think it's an important question. I mean, if you think about it, there's a framework. I'm not even sure the first time I heard it, and I'm not going to be able to attribute it correctly. I'll just say it's not mine, but it makes sense. And that is that there are kind of three natures of beauty. There's the first, which is the aesthetic beauty that you would expect when you think mm-hmm. about beauty, kind of maybe intuitively in the English language. You know, perfect proportions, perfect representation of function and form, you know, beautiful person, a beautiful piece of art. But then there's a kind of second nature, which is the beauty of simplicity. And this is where you have this elegant, you know, mathematical equation that describes some fundamental force. And it's beautiful because how simple it is. But the problem with this type of beauty is that sometimes it's a mirage. Right. Sometimes the simplicity is beautiful, but the world has complexity in it.
Yeah.
And that leads to the third type of beauty, which is the beauty of true understanding, like understanding the truth of the universe.
Brian, that's our study. That's our study, your study. Yeah. That's the work we did on scientists, and that's what we found. So yeah, those three types were...
Oh, is that directly from your study? So you can source it for me back.
That's funny.
Apparently... Yeah. Yeah. You did such a good job that somebody's told me the story and was not able to attribute it back, and I was explaining it to you. So hopefully I did a good
that's
job great. Of explaining it.
Yeah, that's exactly what we found. Yeah.
And I really found it to be a useful framework for me to kind of understand the stages. And what I see in our work is actually beauty of each of the kind, each of those kinds. Sometimes it's related to the problem that's solved. I think that's very aesthetic. It's kind of the beauty of a moral action. Like when you solve a problem and you're doing the right thing or making life better for someone, like it's very beautiful. Mm. I think the second one, the simplicity, is the risk, especially when we're innovating. We've done some just amazing innovation. I'm just blown away every day by the team that I work with and the things that we come up with. And I think simplicity is sometimes a mirage. Sometimes it's a good, you know, direction finder.
Yeah.
But we've got this concept that we talk about a lot at Mind Foundry, which is simplexity, which is where, you know, we live in a complex world, and complexity has emergence, and it has all of these characteristics that lead to, you know, what people might refer to as, you know, things that are like chaotic. Or that have emergent properties. And so simplicity isn't always enough to define those things, but this idea of simplexity is, you know, can I see what is constraining them as the complexity is emerging in the system? Mm-hmm. And that's a very good direction finder for a greater level of understanding. And then finally, I think, you know, one of the things I like a lot about the team I work with is the willingness to learn new things that challenge, you know, what we accepted as true before. And that's the, you know, the beauty of understanding is, you know, sometimes you understand that you've been working for a long time under a bad set of assumptions and that you have to change them or you won't be able to move forward anymore. And that's not a loss.
Yeah.
That's not a mistake. That's a win. We got understanding. It's like, this is what it's all about is actually getting that deeper level of understanding, and that we only lose when we stop trying to get that.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have an experience or a moment, that comes to mind where you could recognize this kind of beauty, you know, maybe in an accomplishment that you're especially proud of at Mind Foundry?
One of the stories I like to tell is a collaboration that our founders and some of our team members were a part of with the university, with a larger group that was exploring how AI machine learning could be applied to interventions in mosquitoes in the developing world, specifically with regards to malaria. And it's just a really inspiring project. Again, it was something that we collaborated on with a lot of brilliant people from foundations, from the university, and we were just honored to be a part of, but it was to listen to mosquitoes with a cell phone and tell if they're carrying the malaria parasite, right? So it was at the cutting edge of modeling with, you know, specifically with regards to sensors, which is an area that Mind Foundry focuses on, but applied in something that just had, you know, sweeping implications. And it's really beautiful to see, you know, what is the most cutting edge technology that's normally, like it or not, associated with things like mobile apps and games and ad tech, applied to a real human problem that's systemic and has been, you know, plaguing humanity quite literally since humans had civilization. You know, if people knew the history of malaria and how many parts of the world that you couldn't live in that you can live in now, you know, it's definitely still a part of our story to see new technology applied to interventions in the real world with AI is very exciting.
Yeah. Wow. That's fantastic. Yeah, no, it's absolutely, I think, a growing problem, right? I mean, what we hear with climate change and the implications of that for the spread of mosquitoes and so on, it becomes really critical.
Yeah. There's also a really interesting piece of understanding in that project that stood out for me. It actually honestly blew my mind. And the models are able to listen to the sound of the mosquitoes and tell you what species of mosquito it is, you know, what gender of mosquito it is, and then whether or not the wing pattern is laden with parasites, which is pretty amazing. But the profound thing was we actually found that amongst the volunteers, some people could do it.
Oh,
and that was amazing. And so oftentimes these models are picking up on signals and things in the training data. And when you let them work with people, even though there's uncertainty about whether, a person is capable of that, if a label that they made was right or not. But then when the models are able to make predictions, they're also able to tell you, hey, it turns out that this expert here gets it right all the time.
Mm.
And that's this kind of underlying, you know, discovery about what humans are capable of in the process. Mm. And I love that part of the story as well.
Hmm. What do you think AI can contribute to in terms of enhancing our humanity, our sense of, because, you know, we talked a little bit about risks, but, you know, there are a lot of people worried that AI will somehow dehumanize us and strip away from us or rob us of certain things that we consider uniquely human, that make us uniquely human. But what do you think is the potential of AI to contribute to our humanity and to our sense of who we are?
Yeah, I think that AI itself is just, I don't know, when I explain to people, I sometimes refer to it as, you know, statistical compression, right? You're just taking a lot of knowledge and trying to compress it into this model that you can then use to make decisions quickly about something or use to make recommendations quickly about something. And I think in that understanding, it stops being this alien intelligence that maybe I'm afraid of, maybe it's, you know, dehumanizing me. And it just becomes a tool, but it's a tool that's inspired by the creativity and work of lots of people.
Hmm.
I think that's powerful, right? It's a way that we're finding, how do we amplify and make available creativity to more people in a way that maybe wasn't possible before? That's going to be a sticky mess, because there are artists that have made these things that it was trained on that, you know, way of making a living is jeopardized. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, maybe we should question our ideas about trademarks and intellectual property. And you know, is there a value in making it so that anyone can create profoundly beautiful things and that the ideas are amplified, especially individual ideas? I think it's worth us exploring. I don't think it's, I don't think you can just judge it as good or bad. The example I would give would be, there's a lot of talk about things like deep fakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
These videos that are going to put people in compromising positions or situations, maybe influence the way people think about people. I don't buy it. I mean, it's real. Of course, it happens all the time. You can encounter them all over the place. I think humans do a good job of inoculating themselves against new exploits. I don't think we're as bad as we look from the outside. I think humans pick up on these patterns of manipulation within a short amount of time. You go from not being able to resist clicking on somebody's, you know, top seven list of things you need to click on. Number four will make you do it. You know,
right, now.
We laugh because we're totally immune to it. But when it came out, we have to all admit that that was effective. And we all clicked on a lot of lists that wasted a bunch of time. And I think it's the same with deep fakes. We're not going to be as manipulatable as we think. And in fact, with special effects and a budget, state actors, bad actors have been able to do this for a long time, decades, right? You could do special effects, put people in compromising pictures or videos. We're just using AI to automate the special effects pipeline. Now, what's the good side of that? I think let's look at making movies, individual creators, people who make videos on platforms like YouTube. What if they could, with an idea, with a script, with their personal creativity, make a video with the production value of a studio movie? And then what matters is this incredible storytelling ability of an individual, not that you are, you know, the equivalent of a bank for movie making that gatekeeps what ideas get out. I can't see that being a downside. If we can let individuals tell stories with this, again, maybe profound aesthetic beauty that complements the storytelling and what they're able to accomplish as a creator.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good example of disruption, I suppose. And you know, we talked about this a bit earlier, but are there ways in which Mind Foundry is disrupting other industries, or is that something you're aspiring to do in the future? What does the next few years look like for you, and what kinds of things are you trying to do? And are there sectors in which you are trying to intervene and disrupt in some way?
Yeah, I think a lot of what we do is around helping our customers that work in high stakes applications disrupt the old way of doing things, and maybe disrupt the market of options that they have available to them. Commercially, we work with insurance companies, right? This is about 8% of GDP worldwide is insurance, and their role is to anticipate future risk and be the economic backstop for those uncertain times and things that would potentially destabilize markets, societies. I can't imagine a city in the world, a developed city that manufactures all its goods, its foods, its medicines, what it needs to survive, right? And if you had a situation where a truck broke down and the insurance policy didn't help you repair it, you lose a truck capacity. Well, that cascades. The next truck that goes down, there's less, and then there's less, and then there's less. In many parts of the world, trucks are small businesses or independent individual operators. If they can't get their truck back online, you actually lose capacity to deliver goods. And at some point, you have to make the decision, who's not going to get food, or what don't we have in a city? And if you didn't have that, backstop to risk, things can get really bad. Especially, you mentioned there's lots of things in the world that are changing dramatically, whether it's climate related, geopolitically related. And if those destabilize things in a way where the systems and economies that people rely on to live in the modern age, without insurance, we don't have those things. Okay, why do I say all that? Because insurance is really important in all of our lives, whether we know it or not. We maybe think about car insurance. We maybe think about health insurance. Like where I grew up, that's how you get basic healthcare. Very important. And because it's so important, it's highly regulated. And for them to be able to use AI, they need to be able to prove that they can do it responsibly, that it's not making decisions based on protected characteristics, that it's not being flippant about those decisions in a way that will negatively impact people's lives because you accidentally accuse someone of fraud that isn't fraudulent. It could destroy someone's life. And so AI that can, work within the requirements of those governed industries is critical. You can't just use off-the-shelf AI that people are using for chatbots or image generators. You have to build it in a way that considers the regulatory requirements, that considers the impact on humans. That's what we do. And we make options for our customers in our platform where they can use AI in these highly regulated environments that can they can adapt to the changes in the world. They can adapt their business model in a way where they can be profitable and provide that service for as many customers as possible.
That's great. Brian, I know you're not afraid of the singularity happening anytime soon, but are there any fears or concerns that you have about AI and about how these technologies are evolving?
Yeah, no, 100%. There's lots of things that we should be concerned with. I think the most dangerous decision in AI is when people make decisions on what to do with it. I think it's why, you know, my first instinct is to try to change people's thinking about AI as some kind of alien intelligence, right?
And you
mystify it, and then you take away your ability to assess what you should or shouldn't do with it. And you back it up and remember it's a machine doing something, right? You can make a Turing machine out of mechanical gears. And if you were running that AI model on that mechanical, you know, steam piston driven machine, would you be afraid of it becoming self-aware? No. And so I think with that in mind, what we should be concerned about is what ways does it go wrong? And is that compatible with what you're trying to do with it? And I see a lot of people who get excited and they say, oh, you know what's expensive in therapy is the time of the people doing therapy. And if the AI could do therapy for more people, then more people who are disenfranchised can get therapy and have better outcomes in their life. Yeah, no, that sounds great. That sounds great. But how do AI chatbots go off the rails? They go off the rails pretty hard sometimes, right? And especially in the context of a therapeutic conversation, can you keep them from encouraging bad behavior? I don't think we know. In fact, I might go out on a limb and say we know that you can't. Right. and so there needs to be this balance between understanding how they work, how they can go wrong, and whether they're applicable for those applications, or else I think we're going to have some big mistakes, right? It's going to be the AI equivalent of, you know, Three Mile Island, right, where we've got an accident, right? Yeah. Fortunately, Three Mile Island, I don't, you know, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. Is it going to be the same, though, if you've got a therapy bot that makes a mistake and you've got a million customers? And all of a sudden, they're all having some pretty, you know, dramatically bad experiences. I don't know. Maybe we can learn how to measure and quantify the risk in those systems in a way that can deliver what you want. But I think we need to have a healthy dose of skepticism. And so, yes, we should solve big problems. We need to understand how much understanding we need in order to apply AI in those cases. Likewise, I think, broadly speaking, it is worth considering economic displacement, where AI is going to do more and more jobs. Which ones do we want it to do? You know, I think, you know, it's fair to say a decade or two ago, we all thought AI would, you know, definitely be pouring concrete and making brick walls and doing all the stuff we don't want to do. And we'd be making art and poetry. And it turns out it's exactly the opposite.
And
you know, that's not necessarily what we want life to be. And so just because those are exciting applications and those are the ones that have been easier to progress on, I don't want to say easy to undermine the mountain of work that amazing groups of people have done to get where they're at, but easier than, say, an AI that can do plumbing, or you know, lay concrete or make a brick wall. And maybe both economically and kind of as a society, we should think about making AI that's good at doing stuff that we might not want to do, or helping people that do that do the creative part of it and not the part that's more dangerous or more repetitive.
Right.
Versus the stuff we like to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's right. Yeah. What's on the horizon for you? What are you looking forward to in the next few years? Are there projects or ideas that you'd like to see to help realize?
I am excited about a lot of things with AI. I won't go into too much detail about some exciting new technologies that we've been working on at Mind Foundry. But I will say the excitement I have is around usability and user experience. And how do we open it up so that more people can do things with AI that maybe they hadn't thought was possible before. And I don't just mean being able to go onto a text-based interaction. Like, there's great things you could do with a ChatGPT, great mm-hmm. things you could do with generative images. But there's a lot of other types of AI that are extremely powerful that most people aren't even aware of, let alone have access to. And how do we put that into the hands of more people to solve more of the important problems in the world? That's what we're working on. That's one of the things we're working on my Foundry that's pretty exciting to me.
Can you give us a hint as to what are those sorts of things that are too classified?
I think I'll just tease what I've already teased, but okay. It's some pretty exciting stuff.
Great. Where can we direct our viewers and listeners to learn more about your work?
Well, I think that, if you're interested in the AI that we do, mindfoundry.ai, that's probably the best place to get a hold of us.
Okay.
I'm Mr. Laserbeam on X if you want to see my not so prolific tweets, but every once in a while, maybe there's a good one.
Okay. Awesome. Anything else you want to add, Brian, on this theme of beauty, of both the beauty and perhaps the allure of AI that we've been chatting about? Anything else you want to add to it?
I think that, it was a pleasure to talk about all the things that we did. We covered a pretty significant amount of it. I think the work, that I mentioned that people have done to get, image generating models or large language models to work. That's something that, we have a ton of respect of all the breakthroughs that are done across the industry. There's so many people working on so many different types of AI. Mm. And I think that's a beautiful thing too. I think, you've got these amazing groups of passionate people that they really want to make an impact. They really want to make a difference. And I think that's, a testament to all of the progress that we're seeing in the field and continue to see it decade after decade.
Fantastic. Brian, thanks so much. It's been such a pleasure. I've really enjoyed learning about you and the work you're doing.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Beauty at Work. Please be sure to check out our show notes for more resources from our guest. And if you like this episode, please be sure to share it with your friends. And please leave us an honest review. We'd love to hear what you think, and it helps to get the word out about our show. Music edited by Venkat Subramaniam, and the podcast was edited by Dave Visaya from Podcast Engineers. And thanks again to our two sponsors, Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. For a research project on beauty and science, visit wellbeingandscience.com. To learn more about our broader project on beauty at work, visit beautyatwork.net. Thanks again, and see you next time.